Hello and welcome to the Bright Magic Podcast, the official companion podcast to the new public service broadcasting album, Bright Magic. I'm Rory MacLean, author of Berlin, Imagine a City, and another dozen or so other travel and history books. In this podcast, we're taking you through the creation of this most special album, tracing its making alongside the history of Berlin that, and Berliners who, inspired it. In Bright Magic, public service broadcasting set out to capture, to portray, to distill the essence of Berlin. And in this penultimate podcast, we're looking at the eighth and ninth tracks, Lichtspiel 1, Opus, and Lichtspiel 2, Schwarz, Weiß, Grau. Berlin, even before Hollywood, claimed movie-making as its medium. The world's first moving picture was shown at the Wintergarten on Friedrichstrasse in 1895, 2 months before the Lumiere brothers had unveiled their superior system in Paris. At the time, Hollywood consisted of little more than one post office and citrus groves. Over the next 20 years, Berliners, like audiences around the world, flocked to the new dream palaces to see Italian comedies, Swedish dramas, and Hollywood westerns. But in 1914, the Kaiser banned the enemy's movies. For the next decade or 15 years, foreign producers couldn't, and when the economy collapsed, wouldn't, import their pictures. Hence, German filmmakers responded first by churning out patriotic potboilers at the Babelsberg propaganda factory, but then by creating a cinematic culture of their own. So, J. Wilgus Esquire, tell me about the two movies which inspired you and led to Lichtspiel 1 and 2.
Yes, well, they both, we touched on in that first episode where we spoke about my trip to the Berlinische Gallery in November 2018. It was there in this November Gruppe exhibition where I just walked into one room and I think it was one of Richter's films was being shown. Hans Richter, I think it was. Mm-hmm. I was kind of still casting about for ideas with this vague idea of Bright Magic in my head, and to walk into a room and be confronted with these beautiful moving geometric shapes and patterns and colours. And then for Lichtspiel Eins, or the first kind of abstract animated film in history, I believe, Opus from Walter Ruttmann, appeared. I was just spellbound by it. And a lot of these films were actually shown on one program. I think it was in 1925. Symphonie Diagonale and which we're talking about next time, but also Opus and another of Ruttmann's films were shown as part of the same kind of collection of films. And it just turned me on to the fact that not only were these films beautiful, but there was also a whole series of them. Mm. And it just struck me as perfect and extremely rich pickings for the kind of record I was hoping to make. And yeah, just kind of went further in terms of, digging into Ruttmann and his work, which led me to Wochenende, which we've spoken about.
Yeah. And Berlin Symphony of a City, of course, his great semi-documentary on Berlin.
Yeah, which is, as Wochenende is, it's a fascinating sort of contemporary snapshot of, well, it's beyond a snapshot, it's a meisterwork of its time. So, I came to understand that not only were these films beautiful and mesmerizing and a perfect fit for my record of Bright Magic as it was being conceived in my head then, but they were also, more broadly speaking, they were very important sort of touchstones in the history of film and in the history of cinema. They helped to define Berlin as being at the kind of vanguard of experimenting with film techniques and being this kind of haven for experimental and groundbreaking, new ways of working with this medium. And it was the most obvious thing in the world to me to focus on them for some songs on the record.
Mm-hmm. And within the overall conception of Bright Magic, you've gone from the physicality of Berlin, the Marsch, the Der Sumpf, and then the building of the city, and then Berliners, dealt with them, with Anita Berber and Marlene Dietrich and David Bowie, and now it's what they create, or what some of the things that Berliners have created, some of the work.
Yeah, we're onto the kind of the more intangible, I suppose, this kind of beauty or this, it's almost this thing that's kind of pulling you through the portal to get you there almost. Did you do, and again, that's where the kind of the comparisons and the parallels with 2001 and the structure of that film and, you know, the Stargate sequence there. And mm-hmm. it made so much sense to me in terms of what the record was trying to tell me about how it wanted to be written as much as anything else.
Because they were imagining the world anew, weren't they, through their films and what was then cutting edge technology.
Yeah, as I understand it, you know, Ruttman was part of the November Gruppe, which was the November group, and they were a kind of loosely affiliated band of post-First World War artists of all kind of disciplines mm-hmm. who were, reimagining this. Well, they had to, because the whole world had been destroyed by the First World War, a generation absolutely laid waste to. So they were kind of, you know, wrestling with the new reality after that. And in doing so, kind of heading down more abstract and expressionist, very interesting kind of new directions for art. And in some cases, it's the very first time that film had been used in this way, I think.
Yes, indeed, yeah. And so how do we go from this moment at the Berlinerische Gallery, where you see these films, to you hearing what you should record? What's that process?
Well,
how do you start to hear them? These are silent films, of course.
Yeah. I mean, they have been soundtracked online with some plinky plonky piano music.
That's not the avenue you went down.
Yeah. I can remember more clearly writing Schwarzweiß-Grau, which we'll come to next, I suppose. But for Opus, I don't really know. It was, again, I spoke about it last time, but this modern incarnation of the Vangelis Blade Runner synth, the CS-80, it's a modern synth. I'm not being paid for this. I wish I was, but it's by a Japanese-based company called Black Corporation, and it's a synth called Deckard's Dream, which the clue that it's so closely linked to Blade Runner is in the name. The character Deckard is Harrison Ford's main detective character in that film. And that synth is basically the song. I mean, there's all kinds of other instrumentation with it, but it is such a powerful instrument and covers such a broad frequency spectrum that it basically does everything. So I think I was playing with that and just hit upon, well, not to get too geeky, but just, you know, modulating the amplitude with one of the low frequency oscillators,
of course.
Which is, you know, a standard thing to do on synthesizer. You get a kind of tremolo effect by sending a pulse to the oscillators. And it just emerged, this kind of refrain, this repeated refrain. And I don't think I really knew it at the time, but, you know, at the end of the whole process came full circle and was looking for quotes from Ruttman to kind of illustrate the record. And I realized that I'd basically kind of done what he described his technique with Lichtspiel 1 Opus to be, which is painting with time and art for the eye, which is both beautiful phrases, but he said, the artistic focus is not to reduce a process to one moment, but precisely to develop the formal motif with time. And that's what I did. You know, I had a 32-bar phrase and it's developed with time. It's, you know, these extra instruments and ornamentations come in and it moves, it shifts up and down, but the actual motif has not necessarily changed. And I don't know how much of that was conscious and how much of it just happened.
It's the process which fascinates me, because you're not illustrating, you're not scoring these films. You're, if you like, illuminating them. You're using them as a source material, the kernel to inspire you, and then building on that.
Yeah, and I don't actually watch them when I'm writing either. I don't have them kind of on a loop. Once I've got to a certain level with them, I do go back and check and just play it alongside and just make sure it's working, or that it could be made to work, because we obviously have the luxury of being able to edit these films to the music that we write, which gives them the appearance of fitting them quite well in some cases where they don't. I kind of hold on to this image in my head of what the film is to me, and I don't then watch it again while I'm trying to write the music around it and trying to conjure some kind of sound world that, to me, evokes it. And then at the end, you get to marry the two together when you play live, and hopefully it meets in a sort of powerful and moving way.
And you hear those sounds. You must, in your mind, you hear a sound which illuminates, which springs from that kernel.
I think so. And you know, and it's a case of one thing leads to another. So, you'd start with one chord and then you'd be playing with the progression and you'd be varying it and trying to do things that you find interesting as a writer. So not necessarily doing the most obvious things. I think the bass notes in this pattern, it's the 32-bar phrase, but the bass notes repeat every 16 bars and it's only the top hand that changes within the 32. And there's a point, I don't really know how it happened, but there's a point I found it's extremely powerful the second time it comes round each time, when you're keeping the bass notes the same, but the kind of the top end has gone into this slightly weird, I don't even know what it is, a diminished or I don't know my chords, I don't know my theory, but it just has it. It has what I'm looking for. And you're flailing around a bit at first, but when you find something you like, you just kind of develop it yourself. And, you know, it's almost like I imagine how you'd start with a sculpture. You're kind of chiseling away at bits and maybe occasionally you have to stick a bit back on.
Drawing the sculpture. The sculpture that is it within the rock. You have to release it. That's the rather romantic view.
You're just kind of, you're trying to find ways into and around it that interest you. It just kind of emerges slowly from that. And you get obsessed when you're working on it on very minute details, but then you do kind of occasionally step back and look at the whole thing and think, oh yeah, no, that is roughly what I was hoping to achieve, I think. The other thing about the Deckard's Dream synth is that, like a lot of synthesizers from the time, nowadays it just says, you just kind of have an octave switch, says octave up or down. But in the early days, much as with organs, it said feet, you know, and you'd have kind of the option for, as with an organ, you have options for harmonies. You're not just adding pure kind of unison tuning, one up or down. So I was playing with that as it went along, and you can kind of hear these higher layers of unusual harmonies kind of adding in and out of the melody, and that's all just on the one synthesizer. It's such a rich and sort of all-encompassing sound. It's just a beast of an instrument, really. And again, as I was saying, you know, as with the space echoes and being able to physically, tangibly touch something and manipulate it and perform it with Gib mir das Licht and many other tracks on the record, but with this one, being able to manipulate this and write it via hardware, via kind of hands-on controls, I really found it quite an inspiring way of working, because it leads you down roads that you otherwise wouldn't go down. I never would have dreamt of adding these kind of weird shimmering top harmonies on this track. It just kind of, it happened because that's the nature of the instrument. You're creating more kind of randomness, more chance and more lucky occurrences, little kind of sparks of magic that just happen. You have to be alert to them and awake enough to them to capture them.
I'm trying to remember the quote by a French poet, and I can't remember whose it is, but he said that the poet should not analyze the process, but should just let the phenomena happen. But what we've been doing through this podcast, of course, what you've been doing is disassembling your work. And it's strange because I feel it's, for you, very stimulating. It feels to me like it's part of your whole creative process, is to disassemble and then reassemble.
I suppose, yeah. I think maybe when I'm in the process, if you're lucky enough to get into that state that I think people have talked about a lot these days, of flow, you know, when you get into the state of flow and you're, it's almost like you're barely conscious of your kind of your physical surroundings and you're just in the act of creation. I think then your mysterious French poet, I would agree with them. But yeah, it's best not to kind of come out of that and go, why is this working so well for me at the moment?
But
it's the nature of the beast is that once it's finished, you do look back on it and think, and it's certainly doing something like this, you know, the nature of it, and hopefully to be interesting to people, is to speak about how it came about. But it's often quite difficult to really...
Well, on the other side, Thomas Edison, wasn't it, who said your creativity is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration.
I mean... Just, on a slight tangent, I know so many people who are much more talented than me on a musical level and all sorts of other levels, but they're not necessarily as bloody-minded and determined to get something finished. And that is such a key to getting anywhere, really, with an artistic endeavor, is just finishing something. It doesn't even have to be very good. Just then you make the next thing a bit better and you learn something by getting stuff done, basically. It's a really underrated part of creativity, I think.
Indeed. That perspiration, that discipline.
Yeah, and it's hard, because 99% of it, you know, it might not be physically perspiration, but it might just be it's not working. And then if you're of a If you have a somewhat difficult relationship with your own head, like I do, then you're not necessarily the nicest person to yourself in that process, and you're not the nicest person to be around either. So it's very testing for everybody, really, mm-hmm. Who knows you and cares about you. So it's difficult, but hopefully worth it. Yeah.
And back to Lichtspiel 1, Lichtspiel 1, which of course means light play, number one. Is Steve Reich influence here again?
I think so, yeah. Well, I don't necessarily think it was obvious at the time, but yeah, this whole idea of having a relatively limited initial idea and this, you know, this motif that you're developing with time, you know, that's the whole modus operandi of minimalist classical music, is these kind of pulses that interweave and move around. And pulsing is kind of the one word I would use to describe Reich's music, I think. So when we had the clarinets in for Gib mir das Licht, and I asked J.F. Abraham, who's a very accomplished arranger, if he could maybe, you know, arrange parts of this track for them as well. We could see if we could weave them together and if it was going to add anything to the track. And it's kind of submerged in the mix beneath the sort of monstrous Deckard's Dream synth, which is doing so much of the lifting again. But it is there, and maybe hearing it in isolation will help to kind of pick it out in reality. But it does add this extra layer of kind of human texture and movement on top of what's quite a synthetic sound, I suppose. And the other thing I was conscious of was, you know, still trying to keep the record has kind of, first with The Visitor anyway, but then second with this kind of abstract leap, you know, this through the Stargate type departure that we're going on now. The record has slightly moved away from what came before, but you're still trying to kind of keep it one piece and one sound world almost. So the instrumentation helps with that. The Deckard's Dream synth is on every single track on the record, and nothing else is, I think. But also, you know, still using some of the sounds from Ruttmann's Wochenende, so mm-hmm. some of the percussive sounds, some of the cymbal effects, some of the industrial percussion sounds that are used on Der Rhythmus der Maschinen, some of the steam and that kind of stuff is still being used here to keep it in the same sound world and keep it all of a piece, even though it's moved off into quite a different territory entirely.
So Walter Ruttmann is so key, I guess, to your conceiving, your reconceiving of Berlin.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't think the record would be the same without having discovered his work. I mean, it's such a key part of it. The sound world it inhabits, you know, the repeated use of Wochenende, the way that the industrial background of that formed such a key part of Der Rhythmus der Maschinen. You know, you've got these sounds popping up everywhere. You've got these voices from it popping up across the record, Machshon and other things like that are sprinkled across it. It's really key. And at the time that I was working with all this material, I didn't know too much about him as a person mm-hmm. and as a character. And to be honest, I still don't, because there's no, as far as I can tell, like definitive biography of him mm-hmm. as an artist or as a human. But investigating a bit more, I did find that unlike pretty much every other major artistic figure featured on the record, you know, or alluded to, like Lang and Moholy Nagy, who we're going to talk about in a second, and Dietrich, who left for other reasons but still left, and you know, a whole host of other people, Tucholsky, who we'll talk about as mm-hmm, well, and mm-hmm. That, you know, they all left Berlin and Germany because of the looming threat of the National Socialists, but yes, unfortunately for his personal reputation, he did not. He stayed and actually, well, I suppose you'd say he collaborated with them, which, it was disappointing to discover that. I don't think it dilutes the quality of the art itself, and I don't think it dilutes what the art is saying, because the art is so profoundly brave and bold and boundary-breaking, and basically what Goebbels would have been persecuting with his Degenerate Art exhibition. So it makes it even harder to believe that he kind of got into bed with them on an artistic level. But yeah, I've been unable to find too many details about it other than that he did work with them.
Yeah, it is very curious. It raises questions about to what extent will an individual, an artist go to enable him or her to keep working? Because he did, having been this the great abstract experimental filmmaker. He then, in the Nazi period, he worked as an assistant director with under Leni Riefenstahl on Triumph of the Will, which is arguably the most effective and technically innovative propaganda film ever made, and arguably could have, did empower and propagate the Nazi vision around Germany. And it's such a powerful piece of filmmaking. As you know, Chaplin nicked its structure and parts of it for The Great Dictator, George Lucas for Star Wars, Peter Jackson for Lord of the Rings. It's just such a powerful, dark moment in artistic history. And, you know, so he was, Rotman was the assistant to Leni Riefenstahl, and he wrote the opening words, which was, you know, 20 years after the outbreak of World War, 16 years after the beginning of our suffering, that being the Treaty of Versailles, 19 months after the beginning of the German resistance, meaning the rise of National Socialism, Adolf Hitler flew again to Nuremberg to review the columns of his faithful followers. And he wrote that, you know, the same man who was such an avant-garde experimentalist. I imagine because he wanted to work. There may be other, there may be family matters. I simply don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't attempt to dig into it too deeply, to be honest, because I, on some level, I didn't really want to know. You know, I didn't want to discover anything worse about him. Like, you know, maybe he was just a rabid anti-Semite or something. Maybe he, I find it hard to believe because the people he would have been associating with, great number of them would have been Jewish, you know.
Yes.
I don't think it cheapens the art that he produced, but it's just a very curious decision. And maybe it's taking the most generous interpretation of history possible and not condoning or endorsing, you know, working with these despicable regimes. But it's hard to know how far one would go to stay in one's own country when it was taken over by these elements and when the only way to work would be to get into bed with them. You know, I mean, he's not the only person who benefited in the artistic world from working with him. He did die, you know, on the front, I think, filmmaking, I think in 42 or 43.
Yes, it was around that.
He didn't ultimately benefit, you know, it did cost him his life, but all kinds of figures, you know, during that time, the ones who stayed, I mean, you know, Richard Strauss accepted a kind of order of merit from him, I think, and seemed to think there was no real difference between accepting gifts or endorsements from them as he had done from the Kaiser, for example. And then I think he did eventually kind of wise up and renounce that part of his life. But all these people, it's not hard to become tainted by it, I suppose.
Very true. Yeah, and it's something I ask myself again and again, something that's actually propels quite a few of my books, is individual courage, how far one would go. Would I, if I was in Berlin in 1934, 35, 36, would I have said, oh no, don't take away the apartment of my neighbors, to let them stay there? They're such nice people. Would I have stood up? Would I have stopped the Gestapo or taking individuals away? Or would I have thought, oh, I better keep quiet. I want my son to go to school and university. I want to keep my job.
It's easy to see, you know, see these people as monsters and to see the people who went along with it as monsters. But the terrifying thing is that they were just people, weren't they? And they're people caught up in this system and they're making their decisions within the context of that system. And we're gratefully not. So it's hard to know. It's really hard to know. But I think I was reading your book again on the way here today, and your chapter on Dietrich, your book, Berlin, Imagine a City, which we've spoken about at length. But the chapter on Dietrich ends with you saying that the glamorous Berlinerin, i.e. Dietrich, gave Western women a model for a bolder, fuller life and showed all Germans, that there is always a choice, which I guess maybe that is our answer. You know, there is always a choice.
There is always a choice.
And her reputation... Well, her reputation in Germany, ironically, probably suffered from her actions. Yeah. But elsewhere, I think, you know, there's no question she was in the right and that her bravery, you know, has enhanced her standing as a person and her reputation as an artist, I think, whereas the opposite applies to Mr. Ruttmann and others of his ilk. Yeah.
Yes. And it's quite funny to turn this around and think about the writing of myths and drawing on Dietrich and David Bowie and Leni Riefenstahl, who was, as I've mentioned, director of Triumph of the Will. She claimed to not have any knowledge of the genocide that was going on, and the Final Solution. And she was sort of acquitted at the end of the war. She wasn't charged with anything, but she spent the next years of her life, and she lived a long time, I think until the early 2000s, trying to remove any traces of her links with the dark side of National Socialism. She was in Poland in 1939 making a film for Hitler. And during her time there, she witnessed a number of massacres of Polish Jews. And she wanted that eliminated, that fact, that truth eliminated from history. And in London, I work for an organization called the Archive of Modern Conflict, who collect photo albums from the Second World War. And at one auction in Munich, there was an album that came up by an ordinary Wehrmacht soldier, which had a picture of her in that Polish village watching a massacre take place. And she bid to buy this album and so destroy it. And actually, she didn't get the album. The Archive of Modern Conflict has the album. But it's quite sort of the dark side of rewriting history, of creating a myth, recreating her own myth.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm glad she didn't succeed.
Yeah. But she has succeeded in the past, because there's very few images still remaining of that prove she was there.
Thank you.
that was Lichtspiel 1, Opus. And moving on to Lichtspiel 2, Schwarz, Weiß, Grau, Black, White, Grey. Take me through the inspiration for this one. Again, it's a movie, Moholy Nagy, the filmmaker Moholy Nagy.
Yes, it's... It's called Schwarz, Weiß, Grau. That's the name of the original film. So I haven't been particularly imaginative with any of the titles of these tracks. But I didn't come to Moholy Nagy through his films originally. I came to him through his photographs and his photograms, I think he called them, which are kind of experiments with film and with exposure and his paintings as well. I mean, it just across all art forms, he seems to have been a genuine genius. And I think... artistically, I think there's two people on the record who I just felt a real kinship with. I just felt that I bonded with their work to a greater degree than anything else. And one was the writings of Kurt Tucholsky, which we'll come to at the end. Mm-hmm. But the other was Moholy Nagy. He's just, all of his art is just extraordinary, incredible stuff. And I'd seen these kind of still images and the artworks that he'd made. And then I realized that he'd also done film stuff, and not just done film stuff, but this Schwarz Weiß Grau was actually this kind of experiment with light. He built this thing called a light space modulator, or that people later called on his behalf a light space modulator. And to the untrained eye, it looks like a kind of collection of cheese graters of various different hues, kind of suspended and spinning at different rates. And he just shines light through it from different angles and kind of films the results. And you get these kind of beautiful, shimmering, changing, ever-evolving, these moments, they are impossible to recreate because of the randomness of this machine that he's created. You just get these amazing textures and colors, and he created this film Schwarz Weiß Grau to kind of showcase his creation. And he struck me as such an inspirational figure. He was in Berlin. He was part of, I think he was part of the Bauhaus movement.
Yes,
in general.
Yes, age 26, he moved to Berlin and was head of the metal workshop at Bauhaus.
And he's originally Hungarian, I think?
That's right, yeah, born in Budapest.
I should apologize, maybe on your behalf as well, Roy. I don't want to be presumptuous, but for any Hungarian listeners, our butchering of László Moholy Nagy, we're trying.
Do our best. Yeah. Our intentions are good.
Hungarian's difficult, to be fair. I mean, it's really difficult.
Yeah, and it was at the Bauhaus that he developed his theories of art education, which still carried on to this day.
Well, he founded, unlike Ruttmann, who we've just been speaking about, he went to America, he went to Chicago, didn't he, before the war broke out, and founded what was called the New Bauhaus in Chicago. Yeah, I think today it says here it's the Institute of Design at the Illinois Institute of Technology.
That's it.
So there you go. That's off the top of my head.
Yeah.
New Bauhaus is a better name, I would suggest.
Yeah.
But you asked how musically these songs come to life and, where you get the ideas from. But Schwarz, Weiß, Grau, it was, it seemed to me to suggest you've got these three components of the film that he's illuminating for viewers, but maybe it should have three components to the song, so three chords. So it was about trying to write a progression with three chords to it. So I think it's... I don't even know what it is. It's F sharp minor or something. There's an E in there somewhere, and it moves between them in a 6-bar phrase, which is relatively unusual for most modern rock and pop music. Is in 8-bar phrases. I actually use 6-bar phrases quite a lot because I find them you kind of lose the very repetitive final 2 bars, which often the whole purpose of them is just to get you back round to the start. But Everest, for example, is our song Everest off our first record, is a 6-bar chorus. Mm-hmm. And the outro of Spitfire is 6 bars. I've done it a lot of times, to the point where our trombone player takes the mickey out of me for it. So it's a trick that I use a lot. And the other thing is this kind of shimmering, moving main pattern it's a Roland Juno synth that's kind of doing the very busy kind of endlessly fluctuating. There's all kinds of tiny changes in it every time, so it's never the same thing twice. That was to try and kind of capture some of this, reflected light, this atmosphere that he's got in this film of just this sort of scattering. And we can debate to what extent that was successful, but that was the intention anyway.
And during the process, towards the end of the process, you play them together. Do you look at your creation alongside the film as if they're complementary narratives in some way or other?
Yeah, I mean, when I get to the end, I actually think it's relatively successful in reflecting what I hear when I see that film and the kind of textures I would imagine one would hear. I mean, it changed quite a lot from the demo version that I had prior to going into Hansa to record it. And certainly in terms of the drums, you know, Rigglesworth's acoustic drumming on it, when we went to the practice before going to the session to record it, he'd actually transcribed the electric drum pattern, and I hadn't intended that, but he'd transcribed it and he'd played it, and it's a fantastic play. And I was like, well, yeah, we'll definitely use that then. But, you know, it hadn't occurred to me to do that until he just started playing this rhythm. I can't help but move to this. I don't know what it is about it, but something about the way he plays, possibly something about the natural rhythm of the song, but it's the one that I always find just my shoulders are kind of, you know, I can't stop them just, you know, slightly bobbing along with the music. I'm looking forward to trying this one live and seeing if I can just look out on a sea of ever so slightly moving shoulders. You know, people won't be going crazy to it, but they might just be like, yeah, I like the groove, yeah. But it feels strange listening to that now and thinking there was ever a time when those drums weren't kind of front and center. They really do drive the middle section of that song so well that, yeah, another happy accident, really. I think even before that happy accident occurred, I had kind of tried to get a lot of movement into the song and a lot of movement into, you know, some of the various parts that you might not give too much attention to. So, for example, with the hi-hats, you know, it's not just one hi-hat part, it's electronic hi-hats again. As with People Let's Dance, it's electronic hi-hat track, and it's also an acoustic hi-hat track, and it's a second acoustic hi-hat track. And then all of them are passed through various iterations of the harmonizer that Visconti used on Low, which adds a kind of extra layer of randomness and movement and pitch and interest to them. It just takes what would be quite a straightforward hi-hat part and just elevates it into something that's much more kind of random and musically and sonically interesting, I think. And it wasn't just the hi-hats that I was trying to kind of apply that thinking to. So, I mean, I'm not sure I would have been able to play the main part on guitar anyway, so maybe that was why I started slicing it up and doing it via samples. But, you know, instead of just having a guitar part that's static and not moving around in the mix at all, I sampled each note and then recreated the theme. The main kind of scattering, shimmering Juno theme is also doubled on the guitar, but it's done in a way that is done with random panning and random movement and randomized samples. So you get this kind of, instead of a very narrow, you know, recreation of an acoustic instrument, you kind of, you're electrifying you're electrically kind of manipulating an acoustic instrument in a way that hopefully adds a bit more interest to it.
And do we hear echoes, if you like, of the main theme from Der Sumpf?
Yes, it comes, it's back in there again. I think it's slightly reared its head in various sort of more tenuous forms, but it's the first time we kind of hear those intervals in Der Sumpf and in Der Rhythmus der Maschinen. So it's back there again, providing another thread across the record.
A unifying element.
Yeah, and you know, I'd like to say this is from studying Wagner's operas when I was at music school, but that never happened.
Yes, oh yes.
But it's from watching John Williams films. That's where that idea comes from.
Thank you, Jay Wilgoose Esquire, and thank you for listening to the Bright Magic Podcast. In the final episode, we'll be looking at the last two tracks of Bright Magic, Lichtspiel 3 and Ich und die Stadt. But to finish, let's hear Lichtspiel 2 in full. Thank you. Thanks for listening. The Bright Magic Podcast was a 4Kicks production, and the producer was Tom Pooley.